Okay, thanks a lot, Tony. Okay, so in this talk, I'm going to explain magic tricks for doing scattering amplitudes. So these Feynman diagram calculations that we do, they're generally extremely complicated, but there can be a hidden beauty in them, and that's what I want to discuss with you. So just an outline of my talk. So first of all, the motivation. So I'll say just a little bit about these industrial calculations. That has a lot to do with what's going on in the Collider program, especially over the next month. But this talk will really be about uncovering hidden properties of gauge and gravity theories that you find in the perturbative expansions. And there's some surprising structures that I want to talk about. For example, simple formulas for large sums of Feynman diagrams. There's also this very powerful relationship between gravity and gauge theories. And then recently, we've heard from Ed Witten during his visit here about curves in twister space and the link to the topological string theories. So the tricks of the trade that I'll talk about are helicity. This is really just circular polarization. Supersymmetry, the symmetry between bosons and fermions. Certain string theory ideas, unitarity and analyticity of the amplitudes. The amplitudes have very strict requirements from physical properties having to do with the unitarity of quantum mechanics. The neatest technique for getting the answer is to guess the answer. And I'll show you how to guess. In fact, we'll guess together what one of these examples. Something very neat that I just learned last week is twister space magic. It's very powerful magic. And then the main thing I'll be talking about are these examples with arbitrary numbers of legs. So first, a little bit about the motivation. So I know some of you didn't hear Ed Witten's talk, but I'm just using it as motivation, so it's not so important if you didn't attend the talk. But in Ed Witten's talk, there was a very neat formula. These are the QCD Park-Taylor helicity scattering amplitudes. They're amplitudes for maximal helicity violation. So it's scattering, if you consider all the particles outgoing, with two minus helicities, and then the rest all positive helicity. So think of just circular polarization. These are polarized one way, and the rest of them are polarized the other way. And you can write down this amazingly simple formula. This was written down by Park and Taylor in the theory of quantum chromodynamics. That's a strong interaction theory. So it's arbitrary numbers of lines of legs, arbitrary numbers of gluons, can be written in this very compact formula. And in fact, there's plenty of other known examples of this type in gauge and gravity theories. So Tony asked me to explain what are the magic tricks used to obtain these. And you need some magic because there's infinite numbers of Feynman diagrams that you have to collect and add up somehow.
Maybe you should explain what those angles are.
Yeah. No, I'm gonna hold off.
That's part of the magic.
Yeah, that's part of the magic. Now, I'll explain that in a second. Now, this is just an introduction, just to I'll explain it. Don't worry, Keith, in case you don't know. Okay, so first let me talk about the motivation. The motivation from the Collider program. So this I'm not going to really talk about, but I just want to hijack this talk just for a little bit to talk about how these Feynman diagrams, how Feynman diagrams are used in collider physics. And it's very important for the quest for precision in the collider calculations. You want to uncover deviations from the standard model. It's very important when you do $100 million experiment, $1 billion experiment, to match the theoretical precision to the experimental precision. At the opening conference, we heard a talk from Siggy Bethke about the strong coupling constant as measured at LEP, and you see there's this incredible precision, experimental statistical precision is incredible, but there's a larger theoretical uncertainty that you'd like to push down. And in fact, pushing this down is one of the topics of this collider program. In QCD, quantum chromodynamics, the coupling constant is very large, so you need amplitudes with large numbers of legs. You can have large numbers of gluonic emission at the colliders because of the large coupling constant. A very famous example of doing precision calculations with Feynman diagrams is constraining the Higgs boson mass. We haven't seen the Higgs boson, but from the precision electroweak calculations, we have a constraint, assuming that the standard model is exactly correct, of that the mass of the Higgs boson has to be less than 200 GeV. And I should mention, as long as there's colliders, we need to do this kind of work. So let's suppose you go to the Tevatron, the LHC, and all of a sudden, somehow, the new physics just sticks out like a sore thumb. And, okay, who needs precision then? But of course, we do need the precision in order to measure and try to understand precisely what this new physics is. But anyway, this talk is not about that. It's more about investigating the structure of field theory. But before I go on, let me just tell you about a major advance in these industrial calculations that we're very excited about. And that's the ability to do these calculations with more than one kinematic variable. So this would be a 2-to-2 scattering, and there's actually two kinematic variables in here. And this is a relatively new art. There's a new loop integration technology that's used for this, which I won't explain here. That would be the subject of another talk, the kind of magic that goes into that. But let me just mention that one reason why there's been a lot of activity and excitement and a lot of development has to do with the influx of a lot of bright, energetic people that I'm very happy to say almost all these people are going to be at, or have been, or are going to be at this program. And in fact, a major goal for the next month is to apply this breakthrough to improving the theoretical precision for collider physics. But now let me get on to the main part of the talk, which is about the hidden structure in Feynman diagrams. So let's consider gluon scattering. So this would be a 5 gluon amplitude. So it's described by these Feynman diagrams. I've only listed a couple of them. There's a set of Feynman rules. You can look in the textbooks. Tony has an appendix in his book. You can find the Feynman rules, and you can start calculating. And this seems like a pretty simple calculation. It only has 5 legs. So let's calculate it. Well, this is the answer. Well, actually, it's only a very small part of the answer. If you just follow the Feynman rules in Tony and others' books, this is expressed in terms of polarization vectors. So this is a 4 vector describing the polarization. These are momenta. And it's some mess. Actually, the complete answer is about 25 of these pages. But I decided not to show that to you. So clearly, there's something very unenlightening about this. So let's use a little magic, a little Chinese magic. This is sometimes called Chinese magic because of Xu Zhang and Chang's formalism, which is particularly nice. A lot of people have worked on, this is known as spinner helicity. These are helicity techniques, circular polarization. But this particular form I'm showing you here was done by Xu Zhang and Chang, and it's quite nice. So what you do is you take the polarization vector and you express it in terms of spinners, spinner inner products. Up there, those are Weyl spinners, just ordinary kinds of spinners for different helicities. There's plus helicity spinners and minus helicity spinners. The polarization vector is described in terms of two momenta. It's the momentum of the gluon. And then there's another vector, another reference momentum. It's some arbitrary momentum that you put into the problem. But the different choices of this reference momentum, you can show are equivalent to gauge transformation, so they drop out of the answer. So you can choose things as you please. in order to simplify your life. Although it's a little bit peculiar why you would want to write a polarization vector in terms of spinners, it's in fact quite straightforward to check that in fact this is a good polarization vector. That if you can show that it satisfies everything that circular polarization is supposed to satisfy. And in Ed's talk, he used a different kind of notation than the notation I'm going to use, which now Keith is happy because I've defined what these brackets are. So these are spinner inner products. The square bracket that you're also going to see in the talk, that's essentially a complex conjugate. It has the opposite helicity. It's opposite helicity spinners. So when you see the pluses and minuses, they refer to the helicity of these spinners. These spinner inner products, they're square roots of a Lorentz invariance times some kind of a phase. This is not a particularly good way to write it. You want to write it in terms of these spinner inner products here. You know, something that will appear a little bit later in my talk is this following fact that's kind of neat, that a graviton polarization tensor can be written as product of these polarization vectors of the gluons. In fact, I'm going to show you that the entire scattering amplitude has this property, not just the polarization vectors. So here's what happens when you use the Chinese magic. It's the same answer as on the previous transparencies. It contains exactly the same information. You've lost no information in going to these simple formulas written in terms of these spinner inner products. Now that's a pretty neat formula, I think. Now I should say that there's no color here. You may remember in quantum chromodynamics there's a color degree of freedom. It's been stripped away from here, and also in a very neat way. Also there's a little bit of magic in lining up the gluon amplitude so that it's been stripped of its color. If you looked at a Feynman diagram, you'd find some kind of scramble between the color and the kinematics, which would not be so obvious how to disentangle until you realize what you wanted. In fact, it was a little motivation out of string theory, open string theory, that explained this is the right way to do it. Of course, once you know what you want, it's not very hard to prove that these Feynman diagrams can be rewritten in a form like this, in terms of these color-stripped amplitudes.
Just to make sure that I understand this and everyone understands this, that so the 25 pages of printout,
it's the same.
That's reduced down to these.
That's
two
it.
Lines,
that's
just
it.
Just by using the right
helicity.
Notation.
Yeah, it's the
physics change. It's just notation.
That's right.
It's just the bad notation.
The bad notation. In fact, I should have explained this. Thanks a lot. The bad notation is that there are 2 degrees of freedom, 2 helicities in the gluon, but we've tried writing it in the bad way in terms of a 4-vector when there's only 2 degrees of freedom. So the answer is don't write it in terms of unphysical degrees of freedom. Write it in terms of the physical 2 degrees of freedom. Once you do that, then things clean up extremely nicely. So the general themes that you're going to see in this talk are a deeper theoretical understanding can lead to calculational improvements, and the other thing you're going to learn is recycling is good. So you know you're supposed to recycle bottles, newspapers, you know, et cetera, plastic. Well, I'm here to say that you're supposed to recycle calculations.
So back to one more question, that 25 pages of stuff, that covers all helicities. The one simple formula is only for a particular helicity.
But it has, no, but they're all trivially related. You're right, but I could have, on the same line, I could have written down all of them on the same line if I made, you see, I could have labeled it IJ, which are the minus ones, and I would have put an IJ there. I also can stick it on one line. This is only one example, but I can put all of it, all the helicities, in one fell swoop on these 2 lines, one way or the other. You already saw the example of helicity, the deeper theoretical understanding, and it's perhaps not so profound that you're not supposed to be using a bad representation in terms of four vectors when you only have 2 degrees of freedom. So that theoretical understanding, of course, as you saw, very spectacularly leads to this calculational improvements. I'm going to show you about supersymmetry, recursive methods, unitarity, and then gravity amplitudes, how to get gravity from gauge theory, and then best of all, twister space. But I see I have to hurry up. Okay, so let me show you how Park and Taylor got their answer. So what they did is they calculated up to the 6 point, and then they saw the pattern, and then they guessed this form here. But they knew that it was right, even though they didn't have a proof for it, because they understood the factorization properties. In quantum field theory, if you have a scattering amplitude, every pole you see corresponds to a particle propagating. If you look at these maximal helicity violating amplitudes, then, for example, on this side of that pole, you have to have a maximal helicity violating amplitude, and you can see that this guy would vanish. So all multiparticle poles vanish. And then there's also conditions about particles getting softer collinear. If momenta becomes softer collinear, there's also stringent requirements. So they were already pretty sure without doing a calculation. But the way it's proven, this was then proven by Behrens and Gill using these recursive techniques. If you look at this recursion formula, you'll say, but wait a second, that's just the Schwinger-Dyson equation. Why is that magic? Well, the magic is that you can solve it. That's magical. See, what you do is you write down an ansatz, a guess, with the helicities for certain helicity configurations, and then you can prove that that recursion relation is satisfied. And then actually, once you have this recursion, once you have the solution of the recursion relation, you're done. As soon as you dock this free index into a minus helicity polarization, you just have to clean it up a little bit, and that's all you need to prove that the Park-Taylor amplitudes are correct. And this is quite neat because you've just solved an infinite number of Feynman diagrams in one fell swoop. If you look at an ordinary Feynman diagram, you could really see that there really should be a recursive structure because you're building them by gluing more and more pieces on. And this equation here just summarizes that recursive structure. And there's various applications, proof of the Park-Taylor formula, amplitudes with more negative helicities, so beyond the maximal helicity violating ones, numerical evaluations, and also some work when you introduce quantum loops. Another very neat trick is supersymmetry. So supersymmetry is one of the ideas for going beyond the standard model. And of course, the most important question is, does it exist in nature? Of course, that can only be answered by experiment. But whether it exists in nature or not, supersymmetry is a very helpful tool. It teaches us a lot about the structure of gauge theory, even in cases which are not supersymmetric. So QCD is not a supersymmetric theory. It has no supersymmetry. There's no special relationship between the gluons and the fermions. The quarks live in fundamental color representation of SU3. If you had a supersymmetric theory, you would be putting not quarks, but you call them now gluinos, and you put them in a different color representation. But I already showed you that the color can be stripped away. So the fact they're in different representations is not important as far as supersymmetry is concerned. So for all practical purposes, at least at tree level, where you just draw trees, QCD is as good as N equals 1 super Yang Mills. So now you can start proving Ward identities, supersymmetry Ward identities. Q is the supercharge. If the vacuum is supersymmetric, then the supercharge has to vanish on the vacuum. You write down a commutator. The commutator has to vanish because on either side you get a zero from the supercharge annihilating the vacuum. And then you can also use the supersymmetry transformations. This takes a gluon field and turns it into a gluino, takes a gluino, turns it into a gluon. And from here you can get some nice Ward identities that relate quark amplitudes of QCD to the gluon amplitudes also of QCD. And here's some sample tricks that were used, sample places where this was applied. So this was done, one trick is to relate gluon amplitudes to much simpler scalar amplitudes, and that was done by Park and Taylor back in 85. Zoltan Kunst, who's
here.
Yes, also applied exactly this kind of trickery to obtain the six gluon non-maximal helicity violating amplitudes, which are going to play an important role in my talk later. Back in the days when this was actually really tough, when this was, you'd be dealing with 220 Feynman diagrams. But I'm happy to report that as of today, you can actually do that calculation on the back of an envelope. 220 Feynman diagrams. And in fact, I'll do it for you. But you have to wander just a little bit into this twister space. Okay? Other examples, the for loop QCD beta function. It was used as a check in this calculation. If you don't know what a beta function is, you should ask David Gross, but I guess he's not here, so I guess you can't ask him right now. Anyway, this is something very important in QCD. It tells us about the scaling properties of the theory. Another more recent example is in the 2-to-2 scattering of two loops, the supersymmetry was used to verify that the calculation, the QCD calculation, was done correctly. As I explained to you, the difference between QCD and a supersymmetric theory is very little. It's really just a matter of color representations. Okay, let's talk about gravity theories. So here are two Lagrangians, well-known Lagrangian of gravity, the well-known Lagrangian of Yang-Mills. We look at the three vertex of Yang-Mills. It's something that's relatively nice. It's not too bad. That tells you how the three gluons interact. Now let's look at the gravity one. Well, the gravity one, I had to use some tricks to get it to fit on this slide because this P6 refers to six permutations, so there's actually six terms. And if you look at this, there are actually about 100 terms in here. So you look at this and you say, oh, I guess that means that gravity is just a mess. And then you might also conclude that this theory of gravity, the way gravitons couple and the way gluons couple, it has nothing to do with each other. Right? But this can't be right, because we know that string theory, for example, it unifies gravity and gauge theory. So there must be some common language for describing these two theories. And it's a very simple intuition. If you look at a closed string theory, so if you open up your favorite textbook on string theory, either Joe's or Green, Schwartz, and Witten, you will immediately see a very striking fact. A closed string looks like a product of open strings. The line one thing, as soon as you open up the books, that's what you're going to see in the construction of a closed string amplitude. Well, in the low energy limit, closed string is supposed to be a gravity theory. Open strings are supposed to be gauge theories. So that immediately tells you that gravity must be products of gauge theories. Just from that intuition. Of course, we want to make this precise, we want to exploit this, and these two things I will discuss here. The thing I won't discuss here is how this can be understood from the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian, because I just showed you that they look completely different, at least the vertices of the theory look completely different. There's two papers I just want to point to, one by Warren Siegel and one by us, where we tried at least initial steps in trying to address this question. Well, in string theory, there's some precise formulas that tell us what to expect. So Kawhi Llewellyn and Tai wrote this down between open strings and closed strings, and then later it was realized, I mean, it's kind of an obvious fact, if you take the low energy limit, it must then imply relationships between gravity theories, gravity amplitudes, and gauge theory amplitudes. So, on this side here, I have a four graviton scattering. On the other side here, I have four gluon scattering. And I really mean four gluon scattering of QCD. On this side, I really mean four graviton scattering of Einstein's theory. And this is five gravitons. This is five gluons. And once again, these are color-ordered, color-stripped amplitudes on the gauge theory side. And in fact, these relationships, they hold for any state that you find in the string, and there's also for arbitrary numbers of legs at tree level. These are tree level relationships. Very beautiful relationships on the final amplitude, that there's a sum of products. So it's exactly what I said. Gravity the gravity amplitude must be a product of gauge theory amplitudes. Sum of products. It also holds beyond the low energy limit. There's a recent paper from Niels Bohr. Actually, it's his great-grandson, where they look at higher dimension operators. If you add higher dimension operators both to the Yang-Mills side and to the gravity side, you can again find similar relationships. Let me show you an example of this. Suppose I want the 4-graviton amplitude. So this is 4-graviton scattering of Einstein's theory. If I want to know what it is, well, I could write down the Feynman diagrams, but here's a better way. What you do is you work out the gauge theory amplitudes, which are well known. In fact, these are already included in that Park-Taylor formula. And then you multiply them. You say multiply, and that's the answer. Or if I want to add matter, here's another neat one. You add matter, you can make gluons with gravitons. You can also play very similar games. In fact, you can go to arbitrary numbers of legs, because we know the Park-Taylor formula in QCD, so that means that we should be able to construct something completely analogous in the gravity theory. Arbitrary numbers of legs, maximal helicity violating amplitudes. So two minuses and the rest plus. And here's the formula. This was by Behrens, Giel, and Keif. And in fact, the same idea, you can couple gravity to matter. You can write down very similar formulas, arbitrary numbers of legs. So the key idea here, if you know a gauge theory amplitude, then immediately know the corresponding gravity amplitudes at tree level.
What is the case last there?
Where?
In the formula of the gravity side, you always note only a single polarization index.
Yeah, I need a double. It's because I like to save indices. That's right. There needs to be
minus
two.
Always means double minus.
You got it. Minus means double minus in this formula. Plus means double plus, and there's no plus minus in the formula. There's no graviton polarization like that. So yes, I have saved myself a little writing, but I have been a little bit sloppy. You're absolutely right. Yeah, was it? Where? Oh, here. This is the sum. It's a sum over momenta between these two indices. Okay, let me go on to loops. So at loop level, the situation is a little more complicated. People obviously have not gone as far because of the complexity of the loop calculations. Just one example, this is a state-of-the-art calculation. In fact, we're going to hear about this work next week from Laura Reyna. This is quarks into Higgs associated with top. And that's where the state-of-the-art is. Okay, at 6 points, if you go to 6 points, so one more leg, there's only very special cases are known. So n equals 4 super Yang-Mills, and also the Yukawa model, by Thomas Binoth and his collaborators, and Thomas is sitting somewhere. Heinrich, there's one, there's two. Okay. Certain special cases, I'm going to show you examples for arbitrary numbers of legs in QCD, but it's just one special helicity configuration. Supersymmetric gauge theories, and also gravity theories. But these are all limited to these maximal helicity violating configurations. So here I want to discuss not the industrial applications, but the special purpose of going to very high numbers of legs to try to understand the structure of field theory. So first, just a couple words about applications of string theory. There's something actually kind of neat about the way string theory organizes amplitudes. If you look at the string perturbation theory, at one loop, so now we're talking about one loop amplitudes, the entire, for arbitrary numbers of legs, the entire answer goes into one string diagram. Instead of being splattered out into, let's say, for 2 to 3 at one loop, you'd have 469 Feynman diagrams of for these pure glue cases. So this idea, it led to some rules, string-based rules, which were used for doing this five-point calculation. Okay, and some of the things we learned from this is, well, first, it was the first place where these helicity methods were used at loop level. In the string formulation, it was clear how to do it. Now, of course, now it's very obvious how to do it. The one-loop color decompositions, the way the supersymmetry acts in the string was very obvious. So it led to decompositions of QCD into SUSY and non-supersymmetric parts, which then got us thinking about how to go to arbitrary numbers of legs. We observed in the five-point certain structures which suggested that we could go a lot further, at least in special cases. So this got us thinking about unitarity. Now, unitarity is a very basic property of quantum field theory, of quantum mechanics, very basic property. So the scattering matrix has to be unitary. If you take S equals 1 plus IT, these T's are essentially the Feynman diagrams. You get what's known as the optical theorem. It tells you that the imaginary part is given by a Lorentz invariance phase space integral over over squared amplitudes. So these two are on shell. These legs are on shell. This is a squared matrix element. So this would go into a cross-section calculation. But this is a tree level is related to one loop. Higher loops are related to lower loops. And then the idea is that we feed these tree amplitudes. These T's represent tree amplitudes, like those Parth-Taylor amplitudes. We're going to try to feed into these unitarity cuts in order to build loop amplitudes. So it's to take the magic of the Parth-Taylor formula and try to push it to quantum loops. Let's get the H-bar in here. Right? At tree level, there's no H-bar. Whenever you have one of these loops, you get an H-bar. Okay. So the unitarity relation, it gives you the imaginary part of a one-loop amplitude or of a higher loop amplitude in terms of here it'd be in terms of tree amplitudes, or higher loop in terms of one loop. Let's say two loop in terms of one loop, or here you have one loop in terms of tree. And you get these imaginary parts, but of course we want the entire thing. There seems to be a little problem here. So look at the amplitude as some analytic function. This is the generic form. It's some logarithm. Or it could be more complicated functions, but it's functions that have branch cuts in them. There'll be an IPI, there'll be an imaginary part in general, in some channel, will be an imaginary part. And if you could figure out what the IPI is, then you can figure out what the logarithm is, because if you know this, it had to have come from a logarithm. And you could dress this up in some fancy language and call it dispersion relations, but that's the basic idea. But you can observe a little problem very quickly. Just think about analytic functions. Suppose you have a function of this form, a times the logarithm minus I pi. If I use my unitarity, I'll get the I pi that tells me the coefficient of a, tells me the coefficient of the logarithm. I look at the b, it has no imaginary part. So that means I can't reconstruct it, right? But there's always a trick. And the trick is here, is to do an analytic continuation of the space-time, which we anyway happen to do for other reasons having to do with taming the divergences of the field theory. So here's a nice amplitude. This one has identical helicity here. Its value, I've actually taken an absolute value because there would be a phase on it, but it's 1 over 48 pi squared. That has no logarithm, that has no IPI, and if I tried reconstructing this thing using unitarity, I take the imaginary part, I get 0, I'd reconstruct zero, right? Well, here's the trick. What you do is you consider this amplitude as a function of 4 minus 2 epsilon dimensions, and then every amplitude, by dimensional analysis, assuming you're talking about a massless theory, which, by the way, I'm talking about in this talk, it's always going to be about massless theories, and then by dimensional analysis, the answer has to be some kinematic variable raised to the minus epsilon power because of the way the loop integral goes when you're doing the virtual loop. Now, if you Taylor expand this out, at order epsilon, you'll have a logarithm. This logarithm will have an imaginary part associated with it if there's a minus sign. So if this S here went negative, I'd have an imaginary part. And that means I can reconstruct these rational coefficients here, and I can therefore reconstruct the coefficient of 1 by looking as a function of epsilon. Okay, so that's a pretty neat trick. So let's actually just jump to arbitrary numbers of legs. So how do we do arbitrary numbers of legs at one loop? Well, the magic here comes from the Park-Taylor formula. Remember what I told you, you got to recycle. You want to do things in a nifty way, you have to use previous information. So if we want to do this one loop calculation, we look at these unitarity cuts. With these Park-Taylor amplitudes, we're going to do maximal helicity violation. And then you notice the magic in the Park-Taylor formula. The cut legs, the ones with the loop momentum, only appear at the end. So all these denominators in the middle don't care about the loop. So on line one, this diagram here that has an infinite number of legs, or arbitrary number of legs, around the loop, is immediately condenses down to a hexagon integral. Okay, you might think a hexagon integral is kind of nasty, but of course, it's a lot less nasty than having to do arbitrary numbers of legs integral. And in fact, if you're dealing with a supersymmetric case, you can shake this thing down immediately to boxes, and then you're done. You have your answer. So the kinds of things that were done with this technology are the maximal helicity violating amplitudes in the maximally supersymmetric theory, n equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory. N equals 1 super Yang-Mills theory. Again, it has to be these MHV amplitudes because it comes from these Park-Taylor amplitudes. I just want to comment, in QCD, it's a little trickier to do this. You can't quite apply the Park-Taylor formula. It has to do with continuation away from 4 dimensions. That Park-Taylor formula, in terms of the spinners, was very important that we were in 4 dimensions. Here we're heading off into D dimensions on these cut legs. So the Park-Taylor formula isn't quite right. But in a theory that has good ultraviolet behavior, like the supersymmetric theory, it's actually okay. If you made an order epsilon error, the D is equal to 4 minus 2 epsilon, and if you kind of drop the minus 2 epsilon, it doesn't matter as long as you don't hit a 1 over epsilon. That's what happens in these supersymmetric theories. In QCD, it doesn't work that way, and there's some other contributions you have to take into account. So using that, you can't go as high, but we did go to 6 points, and then the 6 points allowed us to guess, which then was proven by Milan. Okay, before getting on how to guess, let me just talk a little bit about gravity loops, how to do gravity. So the basic idea here is you take Park-Taylor amplitudes, stick it through these Kawai-Wellman-Pi formulas to get gravity amplitudes, and then stick it through unitarity to get gravity loop amplitudes. And the basic idea is, if you know how to do the QCD, or if you can do a corresponding gauge theory calculation, you can also do it in gravity, precisely with this technology. It reduces gravity calculations back to gauge theory calculations. And in fact, this was used to get one loop endpoint amplitudes in n equals 8 maximally supersymmetric gravity theories. Also in Einstein gravity, if you have identical helicity up to n less than or equal to 6, this number 6 happens to be exactly the same as it is in gauge theory, because like I said, if you can do it in gauge theory, you can do it in a gravity theory. And something else which is kind of neat is the same methodology was used to investigate ultraviolet properties of the maximally supersymmetric gravity theory, and it turns out it's less divergent than people had said using power counting methods. Okay, let's talk about guessing answers, because that's really very neat. So we'll try to guess together. So I'll tell you some properties about this amplitude. So we're going to talk about photon amplitudes. And I picked that because it's very easy to guess this one. So we'll talk about massless QED. We'll make all legs identical helicity. And we want to know what that amplitude is. So you start by writing down what you know about the amplitude. So first thing is that the tree amplitude vanishes because photons don't couple to photons. The answer can have no logarithms because if you were to cut this, you make a cut across it, you'll see that one side or both sides of the cut actually have to vanish because the tree amplitudes vanish. So there can be no logarithms.
What's running around the loop?
A fermion, an electron, massless electrons. It's
okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, why does it cut out?
Because you'll get plus, 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 and then you'll get minus, plus, and that amplitude vanishes. It's more vanishing than these Park-Taylor amplitudes. It's zero. It's just a zero expression. If you want, I can show you afterwards exactly why it's zero. You can have a minus on this side and a plus on that side. So there's no flip of the helicity. And even though it looks like I did flip the helicity, but that has to do with the fact I have this all-outgoing convention. But you're right, there's no helicity flip, but one will be plus, the other will be minus, and then there'll be the rest of them plus, and that amplitude vanishes. So there can be no unitarity cut, and there can be no logarithm, therefore. Next thing you do is dimensional analysis.
This statement is presumably asking you also in the change order.
Yes. Yes, I've only written one diagram. I get tired of drawing diagrams. But yes, there are many, many diagrams with all possible interchanges in there. Okay, the next thing we know about this amplitude is that the dimensions of it. The dimensions go like p to the 4 minus n, where n is the number of legs. So there's more powers of momentum in the denominator. There are more singularities, apparently, in the denominator. Because as you increase the number of legs, you get more in the denominator. Whenever one of these denominators vanishes, you'll get a singularity. I mean, if the momenta happen to be soft or collinear, you should find some singularities. But on the other hand, we know that there can be no singularities. Because photons don't couple to photons, so you can't have any poles. There's no poles that you can pull out of this answer. So let me ask you, what rational function is it that has this dimensions? So there's lots of things in the denominator, but it has no kinematic poles. Okay, time's up. Zero. There is no such function. And in fact, that's the right answer. Now, if you look at other helicities, it's not that simple because you can find combinations of logs and dilogs which vanish in all these kinematic limits. So you can find some non-trivial function. But at least it demonstrates the power of guessing. It's really nice to guess.
There's no symmetry reasons for this? That's known, that there is no symmetry reason?
I don't know a symmetry reason. The only intuitive argument is the one I gave you.
Graph
in
non-zero.
Oh yeah, you got it. Every graph is non-zero. Every graph is a terrible mess. You got it. It's only after you add it up that you find that it's zero. I do not know the symmetry reason why this thing vanishes. But anyway, it does demonstrate, okay, it's a pretty trivial example. And you'll say, well, okay, gee, can you really use this? Well, okay, let me show you the most complicated case of guessing. So let's just go to gravity. I mean, what's more complicated than gravity? And in fact, this answer, okay, it's kind of hard to see exactly what's written here, but this answer was done exactly by guessing. And the basic way that it's guessed is by understanding precisely what singularities belong in here. If you have soft graviton emission, there's a universal formula that describes what an amplitude is supposed to do as a graviton momentum becomes soft. The momentum vanishes. And that structure is the key to unraveling exactly what this is. You find a function, we called it, for some peculiar reason, a half-soft function, because it had half of the soft singularity in it. And once you identify the proper function that has the right singularities, you have the right answer. And oh, I should mention that supersymmetry is used here in a very nice way. You see, this NS is the number of states circulating in the loop, the number of bosonic minus the number of fermionic. Supersymmetry tells you that this amplitude has to vanish if the number of bosons equals the number of fermions. So in fact, once you've worked out a scalar in the loop, you have instantaneously worked out every other particle content in the loop by using supersymmetry. And okay, we don't have a proof that this is correct, but it's certainly correct up to 6 points because we use the unitarity method. Now, of course, the problem with guessing is that it only works in special cases. So you'd like to have some technique that you can use in very generally. Okay, well, let me show you the latest bit of magic from twister space. So Ed was here, and he gave a talk where he showed that if you take the Fourier transform of the amplitude, and this is a funny Fourier transform, these are the spinners, so one is plus helicity, the other one is minus helicity, and you take this funny Fourier transform where you're Fourier transforming one of the spinners but not the other one, you get an amplitude in twister space. And what Ed found is that the external points, they all lie on certain curves. And in fact, he made a link to topological string theory. And this link, it's been verified by explicit calculations, especially here at the KITP by the postdocs. But an important question is, can it help us calculate better? What are we going to learn from the practical point of view? Can we use this for something? And I want to show you that the answer is very decisively yes. And this is unpublished work from Kachizo, Svercek, and Witten. So when Freddie was here for his job interview, he came to my office and he showed me a little trick, which I want to share with you. So let's look at this non-MHV amplitude. So this is the one that Zoltan Kunst worked out 20 years ago using supersymmetry. Okay, so this is with three pluses and three minuses. Okay, it's a heck of a lot simpler than 220 Feynman diagrams, but you can stare at this for a while and you'll decide it's just some formula of some kind that looks kind of complicated. And if I asked you to write down the 7 point from here, you would probably not know how to do it. I certainly don't. And there's a few of these where the helicities move around. There's three of them, in fact. And they all have a very similar structure. But in fact, there's a hidden structure in here that completely breaks open this problem and allows you to write, to do this calculation on the back of an envelope. So let's see how that goes. Well, it has to do with the structure of the curves in twister space. I can't exactly tell you how this works because I haven't seen the paper. They were trying to show me a draft, but it wasn't quite complete, so I can't tell you about this. But I can show you the results, the practical consequences, because I know what the result is. And they were kind enough to let me show this to you. And this should appear pretty shortly in a forthcoming paper. So from twister space, you get the notion that the non-MHV amplitudes, that's the guys with more minus helicities than you see here, you see two minuses, but one with one more minus or many minuses, that there's a factorization into MHV amplitudes, into these maximally helicity-violating amplitudes. Well, once you get that notion, it's actually pretty straightforward what to do. You want to define an off-shell continuation of these Park-Taylor amplitudes. So here's the Park-Taylor amplitude. I am going to take one leg off shell, that means that p squared is not equal to zero. So it's off shell. That's what I need for building up amplitudes if I want to try to sew things together. The definition of this off shell spinner, this is actually ill-defined until I give it a definition, because this thing is not massless and my spinners are supposed to be massless. But I define it exactly like this. Okay, J is just some leg. P is the sum of these momenta here, 1 to n. So I just construct the sum 1 to n, and then this spinner inner product with that spinner inner product, where this Q here is an auxiliary reference momentum. It's a null momentum. It has to be massless because I've stuck it into one of these spinner inner products, so it better be a massless momentum. And now the trick is to build up the non-MHV amplitudes by using this vertex. So now, let's just do it. And let's not fool around. Let's go straight to the sixth point. So this is the back of my envelope. The entire calculation is just the top part. I've just written down the diagrams. I need a laser pointer. Or I need to get taller. Okay. Yeah, there we go. Okay, so these diagrams here, they're not Feynman diagrams. They represent the sewing of these MHV vertices. So each vertex is an MHV amplitude with one leg continued off shell. Its value, I write right over here. So this vertex here is this written over here. I just wrote down the off shell continuation of that Park-Taylor amplitude. In the middle here is the propagator. There's the propagator. On the other side is this three-point MHV amplitude with one leg continued off shell. I just wrote it down. I didn't calculate it. The only calculation here is just writing down these little pictures. I think these pictures will fit on an envelope if I write small enough. You got it. There are six such configurations. You may notice that there's a reference momentum still caught into the answer. And yes, it looks like it's caught in there, but in fact there's a gauge invariance. The sum over all of these is independent of that reference momentum. Okay, here actually is the definition. You see these objects here I've defined just a little simpler notation. And the reason why this is so useful is because of this recycling idea, right? We're using information we already have, the Park-Taylor amplitudes, and we're turning them into non-MHV, non-maximally helicity violating amplitudes through this procedure. At 6 points, there's actually three independent ones, two more that you have to calculate. Okay, so you need three envelopes to do that. Okay, so this is kind of neat, but this is not the neatest thing I want to show you. See, this is the neatest thing. The trivial generalization to endpoints. You want 7 points? Here's 7 points. Slightly larger envelope to do it. The same six diagrams that appeared at the 6 point, except I've just stuck in an extra leg. That's number 7. And then I have two more diagrams where the 6 and the 7 are split. And there's no more than 2 of those, only 2 new diagrams. In fact, the number grows as 2n-3. And it's completely straightforward to write down now 3 minuses, and then arbitrary numbers of plus, and one compact formula. Now that's a pretty neat trick, I think. Now, this is a pretty new formula, and I want to say that it'll be very interesting to explore the full consequences of this formula, this way of generating these non-MHV amplitudes out of the MHV ones, and also implications of what this is going to tell us about loop calculation. So the summary. Yes?
You showed us these tricks applied to just tree level amplitudes.
Yes, this is tree level.
But you said that.
Well, unitarity is going to. Remember, if I know something about trees, I then know something about loops through the unitarity relations.
But do the Witten methods apply directly to the loops?
As of this moment, no, or at least as far as I know, no. But just give it a chance. This is, you know, hot off the press, unpublished work. or very soon to appear work.
So basically the difference between this and the previous work was only for supersymmetric things, and now
well, MHV, the previous was all the neat tricks I showed you. Oh, look, you can go to arbitrary numbers of legs, either trees or loops. It was always for these maximally helicity violating cases. Now, the same kind of trickery can be applied to these non-maximally helicity violating ones. Let's say for collider applications, you need all of them, all right? So,
I was just trying to discern the difference between Witten's first paper on this.
Witten's first paper, it was a very interesting paper, but the practical application wasn't clear yet.
Okay.
Now the practical application is pretty clear, I think. Okay. So the summary is, if you look at these amplitudes with arbitrary numbers of legs, there's hidden dualities and symmetries inside of them. We saw, for example, supersymmetry. If you look at the QCD amplitudes, you can see supersymmetry inside of them. These relationships between gravity and gauge theory is certainly in the class of hidden symmetries if you're looking at the Lagrangians. And now we have the duality to the topological string theory. The two basic ideas that you should walk away with is recycling is good. So next time you take out your newspaper and plastic and so on, you can think of this talk. Then the other idea is that if you get a deeper theoretical understanding, it can lead to more efficient calculations. And this twister space is the latest example of this. But there's clearly much more structure to uncover in the gauge theory and gravity perturbative expansions. Okay, thank you.
Let me ask you the first question. As we discussed in private several times, you know, if somebody comes and shows somebody that 220 Feynman diagrams could be done on the back of an envelope, and similar things happen in random matrix theory and so on, an infinite number of diagrams can be done in the back of an envelope, not using Feynman diagrams. A reasonable person would just say that Feynman diagram is just a really lousy method.
I think Feynman probably said the same. He always agreed that there would be a better method of doing it. Certainly we haven't replaced Feynman diagrams completely because you need a technique that works everywhere. These are special cases. Even these non-MHV amplitudes that I'm showing you. They're all massless still. But it's a pretty good step in the right direction of really having a different set of rules, a different set of computational rules that replace the Feynman diagrams and systematically allow you to build up the gauge theory amplitudes.
Exactly this slide I wanted to ask you. Normally, number of Feynman diagrams increase like n factorial.
Right? Yeah. That's right. But one thing I should make clear is that this is with three minus helicities. The number of helicities actually grows exponentially as the number of legs increases, and you look at the set of all possible helicity configurations. There is an exponential growth in there, so this doesn't address that problem, but one problem at a time. In anything I showed you here, it seems to play no role. In Witten's way of thinking, it plays an important role because this topological B model, it's mentioned on the previous, that the topological B model is n equals 4 supersymmetric invariant. But as you know, at tree level, supersymmetry is less important. The way we were using the supersymmetry in doing these QCD calculations. Also, this off-shell continuation doesn't seem to say anything about supersymmetry one way or the other. I think this is something that's very general, not having to do with supersymmetry.
You know, offhand, one would think that none of these tricks would apply in non-relativistic theory. Do you have any thoughts about that?
No. Well, there are, I mean, you know, there are some, in the sense that unitarity, you know, the application of unitarity. You know, of course, in doing any of these problems, you see, you have to have some kind of deep understanding of the proper analytic structure of the object you're going after. So different problems will have a different understanding of the analytic structure, but certainly the key idea of understanding the analyticity, what are the poles, what are the cuts, you know, that idea, you know, the power of it, I'm sure there's going to be some translation to other theories, sure.
Questions? Okay, well, let's thank the speaker again.